"She is dead. You cannot help," he said, and held me tight when I would have thrown myself from the coach in my despair. Slowly she pulled her hand away from Brianna. She had needed support to begin her story, but needed none to finish it. Her hands folded into fists pressed hard against the white linen of her shift, as though to staunch the bleeding of a desecrated womb. "It had gone dark by then," she said, and her voice was remote, detached. "I saw the glow of fires against the sky to the north." Cumberland's troops were spreading outward, burning and pillaging. They reached Rovo, where Clementina and Shonak were with their families, and set the manor house afire. Jocasta never learned whether they had died in the fire, or later, starved and freezing in the cold Highland spring. "So Hector saved his life, and mine, for what it was worth then," she said, still detached. "And of course he saved the gold." Her fingers sought the ring again and turned it slowly round upon its rod so the stones caught the lamplight, glimmering.
"Indeed," Jamie murmured.
His eyes were fixed on the blind face, watching her intently. It struck me suddenly as unfair that he should watch her so, almost judging when she couldn't look back or even know how he looked at her. I touched him, and he glanced aside at me, then took my hand, squeezing it hard. Jocasta put aside the rings and rose, restless now that the worst part of the story was told. She moved toward the window seat, knelt there, and brushed back the curtains. It was hard to believe her blind, seeing her move with such purpose. And yet this was her room, her place, and every item in it was scrupulously placed so that she could find her way. She pressed her hands against the icy glass and the night outside, and a white fog of condensation flared around her fingers like cold flames.
"Hector bought this place with the gold we brought," she said. "The land, the mill, the sleeves." "To do him credit."
Her tone suggested that she was not inclined to do any such thing.
"The worth of it now is due in great part to his own work. But it was the gold that bought it, to begin with."
"What of his oath?"
Jamie asked softly.
"What of it?"
she said, and uttered a short laugh.
"Hector was a practical man. The Stuarts were finished. What need had they of gold in Italy?"
"Practical," I repeated, surprising myself. I hadn't meant to speak, but I thought I had heard something odd in the way she spoke the word. Evidently, I had. She turned around to face us, turning toward my voice. She was smiling, but a chill ran down my backbone at the sight of it.
"Aye, practical," she said, nodding. "My daughters were dead. He saw no reason to waste tears upon them. He never spoke of them, and would not let me speak either. He had been a man of worth once. He would be, again. Not so easy here, had anyone known."
She breathed out, a heavy sound of stifled anger.
"I dare say there are none in this land who even ken I was once a mother."
"You still are," said Brianna softly. "That much I know." She glanced at me, and her blue eyes met mine, dark with understanding. I felt the sting of tears behind the smile I gave her back. Yes, that much she knew, as did I. "So did Jocasta." The lines of her face relaxed for a moment, fury and remembered despair displaced for a moment by longing. She walked slowly to where Brianna sat on her stool and laid her free hand on Bree's head. It rested there for a moment, then slid down, the long, sensitive fingers probing Brianna's strong cheekbones, her wide lips and long, straight nose, tracing the small track of the wetness down her cheek.
"Aye, Alannon," she said softly, "ye ken what I mean.
And you can know why I would leave this place to you, or to your blood.
Jamie coughed, breaking in before Bree could answer.
Aye, he said, in a matter-of-fact tone. So that is what you told the Irishman tonight. Not all the story, to be sure, but that you have no gold here.
Jocasta's hands dropped from Brianna's face, and she turned to face Jamie.
Aye, I told them. Him. Told him that for all I kent, those chests were still buried in the wood in Scotland. He was welcome, I said, to go and dig there, and it suited him.
One corner of her mouth curled up in a bitter smile.
He wasn't inclined to take your word for it.
She shook her head, lips pressed together.
He wasn't a gentleman, she said again. I canna say how it might have fallen out, for I sat near the bed, and I keep a wee knife beneath my pillow, or wouldn't I have suffered him to lay hands on me unscathed. Before I could reach for it, though, I heard footsteps in the dressing room.
She waved a hand toward the door near the fireplace. Her dressing room lay beyond, joining her bedroom to another, the room that had once been Hector Cameron's and was now presumably Duncan's. The intruders had heard the footsteps too. The Irishman hissed something to his friend, then moved away from Jocasta toward the hearth. The other fellow had come close then and seized her from behind, a hand across her mouth.
All I could tell you from that was that the fellow wore a cap pulled low over his head, and he stank of liquor as though he'd poured it over himself instead of drinking it.
She made a brief grimace of distaste. The door had opened. Duncan had come in, and the Irishman had apparently leapt from behind the open door and clubbed him over the head.
I didn't recall a thing, Duncan said ruefully. I came to bid Miss, that is, my wife, good night. I recall setting my hand upon the knob of the door, and the next thing I was lying here with my head split open.
He touched the lump tenderly, then looked at Jocasta with an anxious concern.
You are all right yourself, Mukria. The bastards didn't offer you ill use.
He stretched out a hand to her, then, realizing that she couldn't see him, tried to sit up. He collapsed with a stifled groan, and she stood up at the sound, coming hurriedly to the bedside.
Of course I am all right, she said crossly, groping until she found his hand. Save for the distress of thinking myself about to be a widow for the fourth time.
She let out a sigh of exasperation and sat down beside him, smoothing back a swath of loosened hair from her face.
I couldna tell what had happened. I only heard the thud and a dreadful groan as you fell. Then the Irishman came back toward me, and the creature holding me let go.
The Irishman had informed her pleasantly that he didn't believe a word of her claim that there was no gold at River Run. He was convinced that the gold was here, and while he wouldn't dream of offering harm to a lady, the same inhibitions didn't obtain with respect to her husband.
If I didn't tell him where it was, he said, he and his companions would set in to cut wee bits off Duncan, beginning with his toes and advancing to his bollocks, Jocasta said bluntly.
Duncan hadn't much blood in his face to begin with, but what there was drained away at this. Jamie glanced at Duncan, then away, clearing his throat.
You were convinced he meant it, I suppose. He'd a good sharp knife. He ran it across the palm of my hand to show me that he was in earnest.
She opened her free hand. Sure enough, a hair-thin red line ran across the heel of it. She shrugged.
Well, I suppose I couldn't have that. So I made pretense of reluctance until the Irishman went to pick up one of Duncan's feet. Then I wept and carried on in hopes that someone would hear. But the damned servants had gone to bed, and the guests were too busy drinking my whisky and fornicating in the grounds and stables to hear.
At this last remark, Bree's face flamed a sudden crimson. Jamie saw it and coughed, avoiding my eye.
Aye? So then? So then I told them at last that the gold was buried under the floor of the shed outside the kitchen garden.
The look of satisfaction returned briefly to her face.
I thought they would come upon the body, and 'twould put them off their stride for a bit, By the time they'd nerved themselves to dig, I hoped I should have found some way to escape or give the alarm. And so I did.
They had bound and gagged her hastily and gone to the shed, threatening to return and resume operations where they had left off should they discover she'd been lying to them. They made no great job of the gag, though, and she had soon succeeded in tearing it away and kicking out a window pane through which to shout for help. So I am thinking that when they opened the door to the shed and saw the corpse, they must have dropped their lantern in shock and so set fire to the place. She nodded in grim satisfaction. A small price. I could but wish I thought they had gone up with it.
You didn't suppose they set the fire on purpose? Duncan asked.
He was looking a little better, though still grey and ill,
to cover any marks of digging.
Jocasta shrugged, dismissing the notion.
To what end? There was nothing to be found there, and they dug themselves to China.
She was beginning to relax a little, a normal colour returning to her face, though her broad shoulders had begun to droop with exhaustion. Silence fell among us, and I became aware that there had been rising noises downstairs for some minutes now, male voices and footsteps. The various search parties had returned, but it was apparent from the tired, disgruntled tones that no suspects had been apprehended. The candle on the table had burned very low by now. The flame stretched high near my elbow as the wick reached its last inch. One of the candles on the mantelpiece guttered and went out in a fragrant wisp of beeswax smoke. Jamie glanced automatically at the window. It was still dark outside, but the character of the night had changed, as it does soon before dawn. The curtains moved silently, a chilly, restless air breathing through the room. Another candle went out. A second sleepless night was telling on me. I felt cold all over, numb and disembodied. And the various horrors I had seen and heard had begun to fade into unreality in my mind, with nothing save a lingering, strong scent of burning to bear witness to them. There seemed no more to say or do.
Ulysses came back, sliding discreetly into the room with a fresh candlestick and a tray holding a bottle of brandy and several glasses. Major MacDonald reappeared briefly to report that indeed they had found no sign of the miscreants. I checked both Duncan and Jocasta briefly, and then left Bree and Ulysses to put them to bed.
Jamie and I made our way downstairs in silence. At the bottom of the staircase I turned to him. He was white with fatigue, his features drawn and set as though he'd been carved of marble, his hair and beard stubble dark in the shadowed light.
"They'll come back, won't they?"
I said quietly. He nodded, and taking my elbow, led me toward the kitchen stair. Chapter 54 Tête-à-tête with Crumb Cake. So early in the year, the kitchen in the cellar of the house was still in use, with the summer cookhouse reserved for messier or malodorous preparations. Roused by the commotion, all the slaves were up and working, though a few looked as though they would collapse into the nearest corner and go back to sleep at the first opportunity. The chief cook, though, was wide awake, and it was clear that no one was sleeping on her watch.
The kitchen was warm and welcoming, the windows still dark, walls red with half-glow, and the air suffused with a comforting sense of broth, hot bread, and coffee.
I thought this would be an excellent place to sit down and recuperate for a bit before toddling off to bed, but evidently Jamie had other ideas.
He paused in conversation with the cook, just long enough for politeness, acquiring in the process not only an entire fresh crumb cake, dusted with cinnamon and soaked with melted butter, but a large jug of freshly brewed coffee. Then he made his farewells, scooped me up off the stool onto which I had thankfully subsided, and we were off again into the cool wind of the dying night. I had a very odd sense of déjà vu as he turned down the brick path toward the stables. The light was just the same as it had been 24 hours earlier, with the same pinprick stars just fading from the same blue-grey sky.
the same faint breath of spring passed by, and my skin shivered in memory. But we were walking sedately side by side, not flying, and overlaid on my memories of the day before were the unsettling odours of blood and burning. With each step, I felt as though I were about to reach out to push through the swinging doors of a hospital, that the hum of fluorescent light and the subdued reek of medicines and floor polish were about to engulf me. "Lack of sleep," I murmured to myself.
"Time enough for sleep later, Sassenach," Jamie replied.
He shook himself briefly, throwing off tiredness as a dog shakes off water.
"There's a thing or two to be done first."
He shifted the paper-wrapped cake, though, and took hold of my elbow with his free hand, in case I was about to fall face-first into the cabbage bed from fatigue. I wasn't. I'd meant only that it was the lack of sleep that was giving me the mild hallucinatory feeling of being back in a hospital. For years, as an intern, resident, and mother, I had worked through long, sleepless shifts, learning to function, and function well, despite complete exhaustion. It was that same feeling that was stealing over me now as I passed through simple sleepiness and out again into a state of artificially heightened alertness. I felt cold and shrunken, as though I inhabited only the innermost core of my body, insulated from the world around me by a thick layer of inert flesh. At the same time, every tiny detail of my surroundings seemed unnaturally vivid, from the delicious fragrance of the food Jamie carried and the rustle of his coat skirts, to the sound of someone singing in the distant slave quarters, and the spikes of sprouting corn in the vegetable beds beside the path. The sense of lucid detachment stayed with me, even as we followed the turn of the path toward the stables.
"A thing to be done," he'd said.
I suppose that he didn't mean he intended to repeat yesterday's performance. If he proposed a more sedate form of orgy, though, involving cake and coffee, it seemed peculiar to hold it in the stable rather than the parlour. The side door was unbarred. He pushed it open, and the warm scents of hay and sleeping animals rushed out.
"Who is it?"
said a soft, deep voice from the shadows inside. Roger. Of course, he hadn't been among the mob in Jocasta's room.
"Freezer,"
Jamie replied, equally softly, and drew me inside, closing the door behind us. Roger stood silhouetted against the dim glow of a lantern near the end of the row of loose boxes. He was wrapped in a cloak, and the light shone in a reddish nimbus round his dark hair as he turned toward us.
"Who is it, Asmiarich?"
Jamie handed him the jug of coffee. Roger's cloak fell back as he reached for it, and I saw him thrust a pistol into the waist of his breeches with his other hand. Without comment, he pulled the cork and lifted the jug to his mouth, lowering it several moments later with an expression of sheer bliss. He sighed, breath steaming.
"Oh, God," he said fervently, "that's the best thing I've tasted in months." "Not quite."
Sounding faintly amused, Jamie took the jug back and handed him the wrapped crumb cake.
"Who is he, then?" "Noisy at first, but he's been quiet for a bit. I think he may be asleep."
Already tearing at the butter-soaked wrappings, Roger nodded toward the loose box. Jamie took down the lantern from its hook and held it high over the barred gate. Peering under his arm, I could see a huddled shape half-bedded in the straw at the back of the box.
"Mr. Wiley,"
Jamie called, still softly.
"Are you asleep, sir?"
The shape stirred with a rustling of hay.
"I am not, sir," came the reply in tones of cold bitterness.
The shape began slowly to unfold itself, and Philip Wiley rose to his feet, shaking straw from his clothes. I had certainly seen him appear to better advantage. Several buttons were missing from his coat, one shoulder seam was split, and both knees of his breeches hung loose, the buckles burst, and his stockings drooping in unseemly fashion about his shins. Someone had evidently hit him in the nose. A trickle of blood had dried on his upper lip, and there was a splotch of crusty brown on the embroidered silk of his waistcoat. Despite the deficiencies of his wardrobe, His manner was unimpaired, being one of icy outrage.
"You will answer for this, Fraser. By God, you will."
"Aye, I will," Jamie said unperturbed.
"At your pleasure, sir. But not before I've had answers from yourself, Mr. Wiley."
He unlatched the gate of the loose box and swung it open.
"Come out."
Wiley hesitated, unwilling either to remain in the box or to come out of it at Jamie's command. I saw his nostrils twitch, though. Evidently he had caught scent of the coffee. That seemed to decide him, and he came out of the box, head held high. He brushed within a foot of me, but kept his eyes straight ahead, affecting not to see me. Roger had collected two stools and an upturned bucket. I took the latter and shoved it modestly into the shadows, leaving Jamie and Wiley to seat themselves within easy strangling distance of each other. Roger himself retired discreetly into the shadows beside me with the crumb cake, looking interested. Wiley accepted the jug of coffee stiffly, but a few deep swallows seemed to restore his composure to a noticeable degree. He lowered it at last and breathed audibly, his features a little more relaxed.
"I thank you, sir."
He handed the jug back to Jamie with a small bow and sat bolt upright on his stool, tenderly adjusting his wig, which had survived the evening's adventures, but was much the worse for its experiences.
"Now then, may I inquire the reason for this unspeakable behaviour?"
"You may, sir,"
Jamie replied, drawing himself up straight in turn.
"I wish to discover the nature of your association with a certain Stephen Bonnet, and your knowledge of his present whereabouts."
Wiley's face went almost comically blank.
"Who?" "Stephen Bonnet."
Wiley began to turn toward me to ask for clarification, then recalled that he wasn't acknowledging my presence. He glowered at Jamie, dark brows drawn down.
"I have no acquaintance with any gentleman of that name, Mr. Fraser, and thus no knowledge of his movements. Though if I did, I greatly doubt that I should feel myself obliged to inform you of them."
"No?"
Jamie took a thoughtful sip of coffee, then handed the jug to me.
"What of the obligations of a guest toward his host, Mr. Wiley?"
The dark brows rose in astonishment.
"What do you mean, sir?" "I take it that you are not aware, sir, that Mrs. Innes and her husband were assaulted last evening, and an attempt at robbery made upon them."
Wiley's mouth fell open. Either he was a very good actor, or his surprise was genuine. Given my acquaintance with the young man to date, I thought he was no kind of actor.
"I was not. Who?"
A thought struck him, and bewilderment vanished in renewed outrage. His eyes bulged slightly.
"You think that I was concerned in this dastardly enterprise?"
Roger suggested. He seemed to be enjoying himself, relieved of the boredom of guard duty.
"Aye, I expect we do.
A bit of crumb cake with your coffee, sir."
He held out a chunk of cake. Wiley stared at it for a moment, then leapt to his feet, striking the cake out of Roger's hand.
"You blackguard!"
He rounded on Jamie, fists clenched.
"You dare to imply that I'm a thief!"
Jamie rocked back a little on his stool, chin lifted.
"Aye, I do," he said coolly. "You tried to steal my wife from under my nose. Why should you scruple at my aunt's goods?"
Wiley's face flushed a deep and ugly crimson. Had it not been a wig, his hair would have stood on end.
"You absolute cunt," he breathed.
Then he launched himself at Jamie. Both of them went over with a crash in a flurry of arms and legs. I leapt back, clasping the coffee jug to my bosom. Roger lunged toward the fray, but I snatched at him, catching his cloak to hold him back. Jamie had the advantage of size and skill, but Wiley was by no means a novice in the art of fisticuffs, and was, in addition, propelled by a berserk rage. Given a few moments more, Jamie would have him hammered into submission, but I was not inclined to wait. Monstrously irritated with the pair of them, I stepped forward and upended the coffee jug. It wasn't boiling, but hot enough. There were simultaneous yelps of surprise, and the two men rolled apart, scrambling and shaking themselves. I thought I heard Roger laugh behind me, but when I whirled on him, he had assumed a look of straight-faced interest. He raised his eyebrows at me and crammed another chunk of cake into his mouth. I turned back to find Jamie already on his feet, and Wiley rising from his knees, both soaked with coffee, and both with expressions implying that they intended to resume proceedings at the point where I had interrupted them. I pushed my way between them and stamped my foot. "I've bloody well had enough of this!"
"I haven't," Wiley said hotly. "He has impugned my honour, and I demand—"
"Oh, to hell with your beastly honour! And yours, too!" I snarled, glaring from him to Jamie. Jamie, who'd evidently been going to say something equally inflammatory, contented himself instead with a resounding snort. I kicked one of the fallen stools and pointed at it, still glaring at Jamie. "Sit!"
Plucking the soaked fabric of his shirt away from his chest, he righted the stool and sat on it with immense dignity.
Wiley was less inclined to pay attention to me and was carrying on with further remarks about his honour. I kicked him in the shin. This time I was wearing stout boots. He yelped and hopped on one foot, holding his affronted leg. The horses, thoroughly roused by the commotion, were stamping and snorting in their boxes, and the air was full of floating chaff.
"You dunna want to trifle with her when she's in a temper," Jamie told Wiley, with a wary glance at me. "She's dangerous, aye?"
Wiley glowered at me, but his scowl altered to a look of uncertainty. Whether because of the empty coffee jug, which I was now holding by the neck like a club, or because of his memories of the night before, when he had discovered me in the midst of Betty's autopsy. With an effort, he swallowed whatever he'd been going to say and sat slowly down upon the other stool. He pulled a kerchief from his stained waistcoat pocket and blotted a trickle of blood that was running down the side of his face from a cut above the brow.
"I would like," he said with exquisite politeness, "to know what is going on here, please."
He had lost his wig. It was lying on the floor in a puddle of coffee. Jamie bent and picked it up, holding it gingerly like a dead animal. He wiped a smear of mud off the side of his jaw with his free hand and held the wig out, dripping, to Wiley.
"We are in agreement then, sir."
Wiley took the wig with a stiff nod of acknowledgement and laid it on his knee, disregarding the coffee soaking into his breeches. Both men looked at me with identical expressions of sceptical impatience. Evidently, I had been appointed mistress of ceremonies.
"Robbery, murder, and heaven knows what else," I said firmly. "And we mean to get to the bottom of it."
"Murder?"
Roger and Wiley spoke together, both sounding startled.
"Who has been murdered?"
Wiley asked, looking wildly back and forth between me and Jamie.
"A slave woman," Jamie said with a nod toward me. "My wife suspected ill-doing in her death, and so we meant to discover the truth of the matter. Thus our presence in the shed when you came upon us last night."
"Presence," Wiley echoed. His face was already pale, but he looked slightly ill at the recollection of what he'd seen me doing in the shed.
"Yes, I see."
He darted a look at me from the corner of his eye.
"So she was killed?"
Roger came into the circle of lantern light and set the bucket back in place, sitting down at my feet. He set the remains of the cake on the floor.
"What killed her?"
"Someone fed her ground glass," I said. "I found quite a lot of it still in her stomach."
I paid particular attention to Philip Wiley as I said this, but his face bore the same expression of blank astonishment as did Jamie's and Roger's.
"Glass?"
Jamie was the first to recover. He sat up on his stool, shoving a disordered hank of hair behind his ear.
"How long might that take to kill a body, Sassenach?"
I rubbed two fingers between my brows. The numbness of the early hours giving way to a throbbing headache made worse by the rich smell of coffee and the fact that I hadn't gotten to drink any of it.
"I don't know," I said. "It would go into the stomach within minutes,
but it might take quite a long time to do enough damage to cause major hemorrhage. Most of the damage would likely to be to the small intestine. The glass particles would perforate the lining. And if the digestive system was somewhat impaired by drink, say, and not moving well, then it might take even longer. Or if she's taken a lot of food with it.
Is this the woman that you and Bree found in the garden?
Roger turned to Jamie, inquiring.
Aye,
Jamie nodded, his eyes still fixed on me.
She was insensible with the drink then. And when you saw her later, Sassenach, were there signs of it then?
I shook my head. The glass might have been working then, but she was out cold. One thing, Fentiman did say she woke in the middle of the night, complaining of griping in her guts. So she was certainly affected by that time. But I can't say for sure whether she'd been given the ground glass before you and Bree found her, or whether perhaps she roused from her stupor in the early evening and someone gave it to her then.
Griping in the guts,
Roger murmured. He shook his head, mouth grim at the thought.
Christ, what a way to go. Aye, that's black wickedness,
Jamie agreed, nodding.
But why? Who should wish the woman's death?
A good question, Wiley said shortly. However, I can assure you that it wasn't I.
Jamie gave him a long stare of assessment.
Aye, maybe, he said. If not, though, how came ye to the shed last night? What business might ye have there, save perhaps to look upon the face of your victim? My victim?
Wiley jerked bolt upright, stiff with renewed outrage.
It was not I in that shed, red to the elbow with a woman's gore and snatching bits of bone and offal.
He snapped his head to the side, glaring up at me.
My victim, indeed. It is a capital crime to defile a body, Mrs. Fraser, and I have heard things. Oh, yes, I have heard things about you. I put it to you that it is you who did the woman to death for the purpose of obtaining...
His words ended in a gurgle as Jamie's hand jerked his shirt front tight and twisted it hard about his neck. He punched Wiley in the stomach hard, and the young man doubled up, coughed, and spewed coffee, bile, and a few more disagreeable substances all over the floor, his knees, and Jamie. I sighed wearily. The briefly warming effects of the discussion had faded, and I was feeling cold and mildly disoriented again.
The stench didn't help.
That's not really helpful, you know, I said reprovingly to Jamie, who had released Wiley and was now hastily removing his own outer garments. Not that I don't appreciate the vote of confidence.
Why?
He said, voice muffled in the shirt as he pulled it over his head. He popped out, glaring at me, and dropped the shirt on the floor with a splat.
Do you think I'm going to sit idle and let this popinjay insult you? I don't suppose he'll do it again, Roger said.
He stood and bent over Wiley, who was still doubled up on his stool, rather green in the face. Roger glanced back over his shoulder at Jamie.
Is he right, though, about it being a capital crime to tamper with a body? I dinna ken,
Jamie said, rather shortly. Stripped to the waist, stained with blood and vomit, and with his red hair wild in the lantern light, he looked a far cry from the polished gentleman who had gone off to play whist.
It scarcely matters, he added, as he isna going to tell anyone about it. Because if he does, I shall cut him like a stirk and feed both his bollocks and his lying tongue to the pigs.
He touched the hilt of his dirk, as though assuring himself that it was handy, if wanted.
But I am sure you dinna mean to make any such unfounded accusations regarding my wife, do you, sir?
He said to Wiley with excessive politeness.
I wasn't surprised to see Philip Wiley shake his head, evidently still incapable of speech.
Jamie made a noise of grim satisfaction and stooped to pick up the cloak he had dropped earlier. Feeling rather weak-kneed after this latest exhibition of the male sense of honour, I sat down on the bucket. All right, I said, and pushed back a strand of hair. Fine.
if we got all that settled, then... Where were we?
Betty's murder, Roger prompted. We don't know who, we don't know when, and we don't know why. Though for the sake of argument, might I suggest we assume that no one amongst the present company had anything to do with it. Very well.
Jamie dismissed murder with a brusque gesture and sat down.
What about Stephen Bonnet?
Roger's expression, hitherto one of interest, darkened at that.
Aye, what about him? Is he involved in this business? Not in the murder, perhaps. But my aunt and her husband were assaulted in their chamber last night by two villains, one of whom was an Irishman.
Jamie wrapped his cloak about his bare shoulders, bending a sinister glance on Philip Wiley, who had recovered sufficiently to sit up.
I repeat, he said coldly, hands still pressed against his stomach, that I have no acquaintance with a gentleman of that name, whether Irishman or Hottentot.
Stephen Bonnet is not a gentleman, Roger said.
The words were mild enough, but carried an undertone that made Wiley glance up at him. I do not know the fellow, he said firmly. He took a shallow breath by way of experiment, and finding it bearable, breathed deeper. Why do you suppose that the Irishman who committed the outrage upon Mr. and Mrs. Innes should be this Bonnet? Did he leave his card, perchance?
I laughed, surprising myself. In spite of everything, I had to admit to a certain amount of respect for Philip Wiley. Held captive, battered, threatened, doused with coffee, and deprived of his wig, he retained a good deal more dignity than would most men in his situation. Jamie glanced at me, then back at Wiley. I thought the corner of his mouth twitched, but it was impossible to tell in the dim light.
No, he said. I do claim some acquaintance with Stephen Bonnet, who is a felon, a degenerate, and a thief. And I saw the man with you, sir, when you happened upon my wife and myself at the shed.
Yes, I said. I saw him too, standing right behind you. And what were you doing there anyway? I asked, this question suddenly occurring to me. Wiley's eyes had widened at Jamie's accusation. At my statement, he blinked. He took another deep breath and looked down, rubbing his knuckles beneath his nose. Then he looked up at Jamie, the bluster gone.
I do not know him, he said quietly. I had some thought that I was followed, but glancing behind me, I saw no one, and so paid it no great mind. When I saw what lay within the shed...
His eyes flicked toward me, but wouldn't quite meet my own.
I was too much shocked to give heed to aught but what lay before my eyes.
That I could believe. Wiley lifted his shoulders and let them fall.
If this Bonnet was indeed behind me, then I must take your word for it, sir. And yet I assure you that he was not there by my doing, nor with my recognition.
Jamie and Roger exchanged glances, but they could hear the ring of truth in Wiley's words just as I could. There was a brief silence in which I could hear the horses moving in their stalls. They were no longer agitated, but were getting restive, anticipating food. Dawn light was filtering through the cracks beneath the eaves, a soft, smoky radiance that leached the air inside the stable of all colour, and yet revealed the dim outlines of harness hanging on the wall, pitchforks and shovels standing in the corner.
The grooms will be coming soon.
Jamie stirred and drew breath, drawing up his shoulders in a half shrug. He glanced back at Wiley.
Very well, sir. I accept your word as a gentleman.
Do you? I am flattered.
Still... Jamie went on, pointedly ignoring the sarcasm. I should like to know what it was that brought you to the shed last night.
Wiley had half risen from his seat. At this he hesitated, then slowly sat again. He blinked once or twice as though thinking, then sighed, giving up.
Lucas, he said simply.
He didn't look up, but kept his eyes fixed on his hands hanging limp between his thighs.
I was there the night he was foaled. I raised him, broke him to the saddle, trained him.
He swallowed once. I saw the tremor move beneath the frill at his neck.
I came to the stable to have a few moments alone with him. To bid him farewell.
For the first time, Jamie's face lost the shadow of dislike that it bore whenever he looked at Wiley. He breathed deep and nodded slightly.
Aye, I see, he said quietly. And then?
Wiley straightened a little.
When I left the stable, I thought I heard voices near the wall of the kitchen garden. And when I came nearer to see what might be afoot, I saw light shining through the cracks of the shed.
He shrugged.
I opened the door. And you know better than I what happened then, Mr. Fraser.
Jamie rubbed a hand hard over his face, then shook his head hard.
Aye, he said, I do. I went for Bonnet and you got in my way. You attacked me, Wiley said coldly.
He hitched the ruined coat higher up on his shoulders.
I defended myself, as I had every right to do. And then you and your son-in-law seized me between you, frog-marched me in there.
He jerked his chin at the box stall behind him.
And held me captive half the night.
Roger cleared his throat.
So did Jamie, though with more dour intent. Well, he said, we will not argue about it.
He sighed and stood back, gesturing to Wiley that he might go.
I suppose you didn't see in which direction Bonnet fled. Oh, yes. Though I didn't know his name, of course. I expect he's well beyond reach by now, Wiley said.
There was an odd note in his voice. Something like satisfaction. Jamie turned sharply.
What do you mean? Locus.
Wiley nodded down the dim aisle of the stable toward the shadows at the farther end.
His stall is at the far end. I know his voice well, the sound of his movement. And I've not heard him this morning. Bonnet, if that was who it was, fled toward the stable.
Before Wiley had finished talking, Jamie had seized the lantern and was striding down the stable. Horses thrust inquiring noses over their stall doors as he passed, snorting and waffling in curiosity. But no black nose appeared at the end of the row. No black mane floated out in joyous greeting. The rest of us hastened after him, leaning to see past him as he held the lantern high. The yellow light shone on empty straw. We stood silent for a long moment, looking. Then Philip Wiley sighed and drew himself up.
If I no longer have him, Mr. Fraser, neither do you.
His eyes rested on me then, darkly ironic.
But I wish you joy of your wife.
He turned and walked away, stockings sagging, the red heels of his shoes winking in the growing light. Outside, dawn was breaking, still and lovely. Only the river seemed to move, the spreading light flashing silver on its current beyond the trees. Roger had gone off to the house, yawning, but Jamie and I lingered by the paddock. People would be stirring within minutes. There would be more questions, speculations, talk. Neither one of us wanted any more talk. Not now. At last, Jamie put his arm about my shoulders and with an air of decision turned away from the house. I didn't know where he was going and didn't much care, though I did hope I could lie down when we got there. We passed the smithy, where a small, sleepy-looking boy was blowing up the forge with a pair of bellows, making red sparks float and flash like fireflies in the shadows. Past the outbuildings, around a corner, and then we were in front of a nondescript shed with a large double door. Jamie lifted the latch and swung one door open a bit, beckoning me inside.
"I canna think why I never thought of this place," he said, "when I was looking for a spot to be private."
We were in the carriage shed.
A wagon and a small buggy stood in the shadows, as did Jocasta's phaeton. An open carriage, like a large sleigh on two wheels, it had a bench seat with blue velvet squabs, and a scroll-like single tree, like the prow of a ship. Jamie picked me up by the waist and swung me in, then clambered up after me. There was a buffalo robe lying across the squabs. He pulled this off and spread it on the floor of the phaeton. There was just room for two people to curl up there if they didn't mind lying close together.
"Come on, Sassenach," he said, sinking to his knees. "Whatever comes next, it can wait."
I quite agreed. Though on the verge of unconsciousness, I couldn't help drowsily asking, "Your aunt, do you trust her? What she said about the gold and all?"
"Oh, aye, of course I do," he mumbled in my ear.
His arm was heavy where it lay over my waist.
"At least as far as I could throw her."
Chapter 55. Deductions. At last, forced from our refuge by thirst and hunger, we made our way out of the carriage shed and past the tactfully averted eyes of the yard slaves, still busily clearing up the debris from the wedding feast. At the edge of the lawn, I saw Phaedre coming up from the mausoleum with her arms full of plates and cups that had been left in the shrubbery. Her face was swollen and blotched with grief, and her eyes were red, but she wasn't crying. She saw us and stopped.
"Oh," she said, "Miss Joe be looking for you, Master Jamie."
She spoke dully, as though the words had little meaning for her, and appeared to find nothing odd in our sudden appearance or dishevelled dress.
"Oh, aye." Jamie rubbed a hand over his face, nodding. "Aye, I'll go up to her."
She nodded, and was turning to go when Jamie reached out and touched her shoulder.
"I'm sorry for your trouble, lass," he said quietly.
Sudden tears welled in her eyes and spilled over, but she didn't speak. She dropped a brief curtsy, turned, and hurried away, moving so fast that a knife fell from the stack of crockery, bouncing on the grass behind her. I stooped and picked it up, the feel of the knife's handle reminding me suddenly and vividly of the blade I'd used to open her mother's body. For a disorienting moment, I was no longer on the lawn before the house, but in the dark confines of the shed, the scent of death heavy in the air, and the proof of murder gritty in my hand. Then reality readjusted itself, and the green lawn was covered with flocks of doves and sparrows, foraging peacefully for crumbs at the feet of a marble goddess bright with sun. Jamie was saying something.
"Go and wash and rest a bit, Sassenach."
"What? Oh, no. I'll come with you." I was suddenly anxious to have this business done with and go home. I had had enough society for the moment. We found Jocasta, Duncan, Roger and Brianna all together in Jocasta's sitting room, digging into what looked like a substantial, if very late, breakfast. Brianna cast a sharp look at Jamie's ruined clothes, but said nothing and went back to sipping tea, her eyebrows still raised. She and Jocasta both wore dressing gowns, and while Roger and Duncan were dressed, they looked pale and scruffy after the adventures of the night. Neither had shaved, and Duncan sported a large blue bruise on the side of his face where he had hit the hearthstone in falling, but he seemed otherwise all right. I assumed that Roger had told everyone about our tete-a-tete with Philip Wiley and the disappearance of Lucas. At least, no one asked questions. Duncan silently shoved the platter of bacon in Jamie's direction, and there was no sound for a bit save the musical tinkling of cutlery on plates and the sloshing noises of tea being drunk. At last, replete and feeling somewhat restored, we sat back and began hesitantly to discuss the events of the day and night before. So much had happened that I thought perhaps it might be best to try to reconstruct events in a logical sort of way. I said as much, and while Jamie's mouth twitched in an annoying manner that suggested he found the notion of logic incompatible with me personally,
I ignored this, and firmly called the meeting to order.
It begins with Betty, don't you think?
Whether it does or not, I suppose that's as good a starting point as any, Sassenach,
Jamie agreed. Brianna finished buttering a final slice of toast, looking amused.
Carry on, Miss Marple, she said, waving it at me before taking a bite.
Roger made a brief choking noise, but I ignored that too, with dignity. Fine. Now, I thought Betty was likely drugged when I saw her, but since Dr. Fentiman stopped me examining her, I couldn't be positive. But we are reasonably sure that Betty did drink drugged punch. Is that right? I looked round the circle of faces, and both Bree and Jamie nodded, adopting solemn expressions.
I tasted something in the cup that wasn't a liquor, Jamie said.
And I talked to the house slaves after I left Dar, Brianna added, leaning forward. Two of the women admitted that Betty tippled, from the dregs of drinks at parties, but both of them insisted she was no more than what they called cheerful when she helped serve rum punch in the drawing room.
And I was in the drawing room then, with Seamus Hanlon and his musicians, Roger confirmed.
He glanced at Bree and squeezed her knee gently.
I saw Ulysses make the punch himself. That was the first time during the day that you made it, Ulysses.
All heads swiveled toward the butler, who stood closed-faced behind Jocasta's chair, his neat wig and pressed livery a silent reproach to the general air of exhausted dishevelment.
No, the second, he said softly. The first was all drunk at breakfast.
His eyes were alert, if bloodshot, but the rest of his face might have been chiselled from grey granite. The household and its servants were his charge, and it was clear that he felt recent events to be a mortifying personal reproach to his stewardship.
Right.
Roger turned back toward me, rubbing a hand over his stubbled face. He might have snatched a nap since the confrontation with Wiley in the stable, but he didn't look it.
I didn't take any notice of Betty myself, but the point is, I think I would surely have noticed if she were drunk and reeling at that point. So would Ulysses, I expect.
He glanced over his shoulder for confirmation, and the butler nodded reluctantly.
Lieutenant Wolfe was drunk and reeling, Roger added. Everyone noticed that. They all remarked how early it was for anyone to be in that condition.
Jocasta made a rude noise, and Duncan bent his head, hiding a smile.
The point being, Jamie summed up neatly, that the second lot of rum punch was served out just past midday, and I found the woman flat on her back in the dung heap, steaming with drink and a punch cup beside her knee more than an hour later. I'll no say it couldn't be done, but it would be quick work to get mortal in that span of time, especially if it was all done with dregs.
So we assume that she was indeed drugged, I said, the most likely substance being laudanum. Was there some available in the still room here? Jocasta caught the lift of my voice and knew the question was addressed to her. She straightened up in her chair, tucking a wisp of white hair back under her ribboned cap. She seemed to have recovered nicely from the night before.
Oh, aye. But that's naught to go by, she objected. Anyone might have brought her. It's no so hard to come by, and you have the price. I ken at least two women among the guests who take the stuff regular. I dare say they'd have brought a bit with them.
I would have loved to know which of Jocasta's acquaintances were opium addicts, and how she knew, but dismissed that point, moving on to the next. Well, wherever the laudanum, for the sake of argument, came from, it apparently ended up inside Betty. I turned to Jamie. Now, you said that it occurred to you when you found her that she might have drunk something, drugged or poisonous, intended for someone else. He nodded, following me closely.
Aye, but why would someone seek to harm or kill a slave?
I don't know why, but someone did kill her, Brianna interrupted, a definite edge in her voice. I can't see how she would have eaten ground glass meant for someone else, can you? Don't rush me. I'm trying to be logical,
I frowned at Bree, who made a rude noise akin to Jocasta's, but not as loud.
No, I went on. I don't think she could have taken the ground glass by accident. But I don't know when she did take it.
Almost certainly it was sometime after you and Jamie took her up to the attic, though. And after Dr. Fentiman saw her the first time.
Fentiman's emetics and purgatives would have caused extensive bleeding had Betty already ingested the glass, as indeed they did when he returned to treat her renewed complaints of internal distress toward dawn.
I think you're right, I told Brianna, but just to be tidy. When you went to look round, Roger, you didn't find any of the guests who looked as though they might be drugged.
He shook his head, dark brows drawn together as though the sunlight bothered him.
I wasn't surprised if he had a headache. The cotton wool feeling had turned into a throbbing inside my own skull.
No, he said,
and dug a knuckle hard between his brows.
There were at least 20 who were beginning to stagger a bit, but they all seemed just legitimately drunk. What about Lieutenant Wolfe?
Duncan asked at this point, to everyone's surprise. He blushed slightly, seeing everyone's eyes on him, but doggedly pursued his point.
Asmiorech said the man was drunk and reeling in the drawing-room. Might he have taken the laudanum, or whatever it was, drunk the half and given the rest to the slave there?
I don't know, I said dubiously. If ever I saw anyone who could have achieved intoxication within an hour, purely on the basis of straight alcohol.
When I went to check the guests, the lieutenant was propped up against the wall of the mausoleum with a bottle in his fist, Roger said. Mostly incoherent, but still conscious.
Aye, he fell down in the shrubbery later, Jamie put in, looking dubious. I saw him in the afternoon. He didn't look like yon sleeve woman, though, only drunk.
The timing is about right, though, I said thoughtfully. So it's possible, at least. Did anyone see the lieutenant later in the day?
Yes,
Ulysses said, causing everyone to swivel round to look at him again.
He came into the house during the supper, asked me to find him a boat at once and left by water. Still very drunk, he added precisely, but lucid.
Jocasta made a small puffing sound with her lips and muttered,
lucid forby, under her breath.
She massaged her temples with both forefingers. Evidently, she had a headache, too.
I suppose that puts the lieutenant out as a suspect.
Or is the fact that he left so suddenly suspicious by itself? Brianna, the only person present who seemed not to have a headache, dropped several lumps of sugar into her tea and stirred it vigorously.
Jamie shut his eyes, wincing at the noise.
Are you no overlooking something?
Jocasta had been following all the arguments intently, a slight frown of concentration on her face. Now she leaned forward, stretching out her hand toward the low table with its breakfast things. She tapped her fingers lightly here and there to locate what she wanted, then picked up a small silver cup.
You showed me the cup from which Betty drank, nephew, she said to Jamie, holding out the one in her hand. It was like this, I.
The cup was sterling silver and brand new, the incised design barely showing. Later, when the metal began to acquire a patina, black tarnish would settle into the lines of the etching and cause it to stand out. But for the moment, the capital letter I and the small fish that swam around it were almost lost in the gleam of light off the metal.
Aye, it was one like that, aunt,
Jamie replied, touching the hand that held the cup.
Brianna says it was one of a set.
It was. I gave them to Duncan in the morning of our wedding day as a bride gift.
She set down the cup, but laid her long fingers across the top of it.
We drank from two of the cups, Duncan and I, with our breakfast, but the other four stayed up here.
She waved a hand behind her, indicating the small sideboard against the wall, where the platters of bacon and fried eggs had been placed. Decorated plates were propped upright along the back of the sideboard, interspersed with a set of crystal sherry glasses. I counted. All six of the silver fish cups were on the table now, filled with port, which Jocasta appeared to like with breakfast. There was no indication which of them had held the drugged